We had a really lovely day of mindfulness yesterday with the children's program, the children's sangha attended. I think there are about 12 children. Is that right? And it was really, I really enjoyed having the children here. It was really wonderful. And I also wanted to say how much I enjoy having Nancy's dog, Dory, here. She's a real mindfulness bell for me when I hear her sort of snuffle in her sleep. It's like, come back. How wonderful. And I also wanted to just tell you how much I enjoy that you're here. So we're beginning a practice period for the fall. And it's going to be looking at the 5 mindfulness trainings. And our teacher, Tai, has a couple of books out. This is the old one, For a Future to be Possible. And they're very readily available in used bookstores. And I recommend this book. There's also a newer copy out. They're exactly the same, although this has a little more stuff in it. For one of the things that's in this book that's not in the new little book is the Sutra on the White-Clad Disciple, which is a sutra that the Buddha spoke to lay people. I guess lay people in the time of the Buddha must have worn white. And so it was the sutra to the white-clad disciple. That is also available in the Plum Village Chant book or in Mountain Lamp Sutra book, which we have here. And I'd like people to read that sutra. I have a number of handouts. I'm not sure I have enough for everyone here. However, if you wanted to participate in the full practice period, there is a sign-up sheet, a registration form that's out on the table, and you can sign up and have everything emailed to you through the whole practice period. We ask that people who want to do the full practice period to indeed engage in the full practice period, which means making a few commitments to deepen your practice. We're calling this a practice period renewing our practice and deepening our study of the 5 mindfulness trainings. So in order to renew our practice, it helps to make some commitments. And those are commitments we make to ourselves. Of course, nobody checks on us. but we might make them to the Buddha. However we perceive the Buddha. Some of us might understand the Buddha as Thai. And so we make that commitment to Thai. Some of us might perceive the Buddha as our own deepest nature, our own truest nature. And we make that commitment to that which is good and filled with light that's in our own being. So the practice during the practice period, the commitments are to deepen our practice by attending all the weekly events of our sangha, maintaining a daily sitting meditation practice, practicing walking meditation in a beautiful place in nature, and nourishing ourselves with trees, fresh air, the good earth, at least once a week. And to begin or maintain our journal of our practice of the 5 mindfulness trainings. And to have a Dharma friend that we meet with at least twice during the practice period to get to know each other, to share about our lives and our practice. commitments aren't very onerous. They're actually a great pleasure. And they're offered to you to support you in practice. And they also reflect us. If we have a sense that we're going to be resistant about some of this, that's a reflection of our own mind. If we have a sense of like somebody's making us do that, it really is just a reflection of ourselves. And, you know, we'll find that as we go through this practice period together, we'll find that the five mindfulness trainings are indeed a reflection of ourselves. Originally, the five mindfulness trainings were called precepts. At the time of the Buddha, they were called precepts. And Tai has changed that to mindfulness trainings because it really accurately represents that they are a way for us to pay attention to our mind, to our thoughts. In the first gatha of the Dhammapada, the Buddha wrote, "Mind is a source of all action." And so the mindfulness trainings are a way for us to look into our own lives, to look into our own deep being, and see who we are, see how we think, see how we respond. And if we understand ourselves deeply enough, then we see how that then becomes the source of our action, our activity in the world. So the mindfulness trainings are a way for us to look into our own lives and into our own minds. And they're a support for us to live in mindfulness, to be mindful. So as part of the practice period, there'll be with each mindfulness training, some study questions and things to reflect upon that we can write in our journal or to talk about in Dharma discussion or share with our Dharma friend. So we'll be looking at the five mindfulness trainings in a number of different ways. I'd like to first suggest that we always look at them as they were originally presented as a precept. And then as the Buddha spoke about them as precepts in the Sutra on the White-Clad Disciple. Because those original reiterations of the precepts come from a long time ago, Tai rewrote the precept in a way that responds to our modern day life, and he called it a mindfulness training. And that happened sometime in the 90s that it was first done. And then recently the Sangha has rewritten those, and it was a Sangha effort to rewrite them. And so there's a new reiteration of them. And we'll look at all of those. We'll look at all of those and look deeply into all of those and how they reflect our lives. So I wanted to start with the first precept. And the first precept is, do not kill. Cherish all life. When we think about not killing, when we take that as an admonition, do not kill, and we look honestly and authentically with integrity at our lives, we see that there's no way we can live without taking other life. That when we drink a glass of water, there's many microbes. When we breathe air, there's little invisible beings. that our very existence is dependent upon millions and millions of different bacteria. There's more bacteria in our gut than in every cell in our body. And so right away we see this is kind of messy. Life is kind of messy. And of course that was the first teaching of the Buddha, was life is messy. Life is painful. And when we look at our own minds and our own lives, if we're really being honest and we really pay attention to what's coming up, we see that it's pretty messy. You know, we're having a fight with our boyfriend, or our daughter is disappointing us, or our boss is yelling at us and has totally unrealistic expectations, and we're really mad at him. If we pay attention to what's going on inside all day, it might be as simple as somebody cuts us off on the freeway, and it's pretty messy inside. And that's about, that's something true about that. And the Buddha recognized that right at the beginning. You know? It's pretty messy. Life is pretty messy. And there's something wonderful about that, in acknowledging that and seeing that as true about our own minds and our own being and our own moment-by-moment daily life. It's like it's okay. It's not messy because we're not good enough. It's not messy because the world's fucked up. It's not messy because it's your fault or your boss's fault or my fault. It just is. It's just the way things are. And it's okay. But the question immediately comes up then, good grief, how do I practice with this do not kill when in my mind I get so angry sometimes at people that I don't want anything to do with them anymore. I want to turn my back and walk away. Or when I get so hurt that I know I'll never talk to that person again. I'll never trust that person again. How do we practice in the midst of all of this? So the wisdom of this do not kill is that in the way of our thinking, of our intellectual life, it's not possible to understand. It's something, if we're to understand it, we have to look more deeply. Our conceptual mind, our intellect, cannot grasp what it means to not kill when we see truly how messy things are, how, no matter how good we are, there's still going to be life taken in our thoughts and in our deeds. So it, right away, this precept says, there's a wisdom deeper than just our mind knows about. Otherwise, the Buddha wouldn't have said this. The Buddha wouldn't have said, don't kill, if there's not some way for us to understand that and to live in it, to live it truly. So that's a really important thing to understand. That what we're doing here with all the precepts is looking so deeply that we understand something that's greater than just our self-identification with our thoughts, with our feelings. Something bigger than ourselves separate and alone. And the Buddha says it's available to us to understand this. It's possible. And in the second part of this precept, he tells us how. He says, cherish all life. The first part of this precept is pointing to the deep wisdom of the Buddha mind. And the second part is pointing to our practice. If in our moment-by-moment awareness of our lives, we bring forth the mind of cherishing, then if we are truly able to practice that, by the end of this week, our whole life will be transformed. Our whole understanding will be transformed. But the fact is, more likely, we'll leave here and we'll hear a siren and we'll go, "Oh, it's so noisy here in the city. There's an airplane overhead. How can I be present when I don't want to hear those things?" And it's not that that's bad. Because the Buddha said, if we're going to get caught in good and bad, and right and wrong, we'll never be able to understand. He said to welcome everything. In order to be able to cherish all life, to welcome everything, first we have to know the practice of stopping. And that is to be stopping all our busy mind, all our ruminations, all our likes and dislikes. Mm-hmm. We practice sitting meditation so that we can stop. When we have a place of one-pointed focus, and we're coming back to our breath, we see a thought come, we smile to it, and we let it go. We don't have to get carried away by it and spin around with it. It's just, oh, here's a thought. And if we are truly cherishing all life, we will cherish that thought and let it go. And as we practice like that, there comes a point where we touch a deep stillness, where we are able to just be completely present with things as they are. And then when something comes up, we see it comes up and we let it go. When we hear the siren, we simply hear the siren. But then we don't spin into a story about the siren. Just let it go. And we come back to what's here in this moment. When we take a step in walking meditation, we touch the earth with our feet. Just this one step. With all our love, with all our cherishing of life, that we're able to take this step. I had surgery on my ankle earlier this year, a few months ago. And I wasn't able to put any weight on my foot for 2 months. And when I first was able to take a step again, it was really wonderful. First, you know, taking a step with crutches, and then taking a step with a cane, and then taking a step with no support at all. It was really wonderful. It was so easy to walk, not to being dependent upon all those things to help me walk. And I remember that when I take steps, you know, how wonderful it is to be able to walk. And when we walk in nature, you know, and we see the leaves turning colors, and we feel the breezes on our cheeks, how wonderful it is to walk, just walking. So when we practice stopping, it's not like we practice a stopping movement. We just practice stopping the activities of our mind. And if we are truly practicing cherishing our life, then we aren't pushing anything away. We know every time a thought comes up, we're right there with it. And we open the hand of thought and let it go. We don't push it away. We just open the hand of thought. And that way we begin to touch something wonderful. Tai talks about being happy. And if we don't know how to practice stopping, then it's very difficult to touch our true happiness. If we don't know how to be present and still in what is being given in each moment, our breath, our life, it's very difficult to be happy. So I'd like to read the precept from the Sutra on the White-Clad Disciple. It goes like this. The Buddha said, "Lay students of the Buddha, refrain from killing, put an end to killing, rid themselves of all weapons, learn humility before others, learn humility in themselves, practice love and compassion, and protect all living beings, even the smallest insects. They uproot from within themselves any intention to kill." I think the refrain from killing, first and foremost, it's really important to refrain from killing in ourselves, judging ourselves, saying, "Oh, I did this right. Oh, no, I did this wrong. Oh, now I'm good enough. Oh, no, now I'm not good enough." And likewise, refrain from judging and in our thoughts others as well. When we can be aware of our thinking and our thoughts, then we know when anger and when hatred arise within ourselves. And we know that when we're directing it to ourselves, we then immediately take up the practice of compassion. We breathe in and we breathe out. And we breathe in and out with the trees and the grasses. And we know even if we can't have compassion for ourselves, clearly the trees and the grasses do, because they're breathing for us. They're giving their breath to us. We know the whole universe is really supporting us. The earth, the mountains, the rivers. And when we can't feel compassion for ourselves, then we take refuge in the universe's support for us. Because if the universe didn't support us so well, we wouldn't be alive. So the universe must love us, must need us, must want us. And it's important for us to realize that for ourselves. Again, this is not something that we're going to understand with our conceptual mind. We can think about it in a million different ways. And the mindfulness trainings are asking us instead to reflect, to contemplate, to meditate on these things that our thinking mind, our intellect, cannot hold, cannot understand. The sutra goes on to say, to rid the lay students of the Buddha, rid themselves of all weapons. In the Bellingham Herald, which is the newspaper in the town nearest to where I live, there was an article recently about a woman who shot somebody who she saw coming out of her garage. She had a pistol and she shot him. And apparently one of her neighbors had had a big robbery a few weeks ago, and so she had gotten her gun out, and she was being robbed. When we have weapons around, there's always the risk of using them. But I think that this probably is speaking more deeply than the physical weapons, which is pretty obvious, you know, that we don't have weapons around. But the weapons that we have inside of ourselves to protect us, that we've developed over our lives because we feel like we need protection. We need to feel safe. But just like the pistol really truly couldn't protect that woman, how she must have felt having seen that man fall over bleeding. What she would have to do to justify that. How hard much she would have to harden her heart. And how much damage that would do to herself to do that. In the same way, the weapons that we have, the things we've built up to protect what we think is ourself, harm us. A friend was telling me the other day about an experience she had with some friends a few months ago, where she'd gone out for lunch with them, and one of the, she has a son who's 14 years old, and one of the women she was having lunch with also has a son who is about that age. And her son is very quiet and introspective and not very much out in the community, but writes beautiful poetry, very sensitive, very, you know, wonderful child. But the society, you know, really supports kids being out there, you know, being in charge. And this other woman's son was doing football and baseball, and was getting straight A's, and she was bragging about her son, and then turned to the other woman and said, "And your son's not doing any of these things?" And she said she just felt wounded, you know. It's like, ugh. And her first reaction was to be really pissed off at this friend of hers. And then she decided that it was more important to practice with that. And so coming back to the present moment, whenever the thoughts came up of the anger, the frustration, the self-protection, she'd breathe in and she'd breathe out. And she practiced really deeply and quietly for a long time, not letting the story overwhelm her. And she said, with that real clear focus, it was like something spoke to her. She had a question. She had a question inside herself. Is how do I understand this? How do I not feel anger at my friend? How do I not feel shame for about my own son? You know, all those feelings. Where's the middle way here? Where's my freedom? And she said she just continued to practice just whenever the thoughts would come up, whenever the story would come up, she'd come back and she'd breathe in, she'd breathe out. And she would let the question be there. She wasn't trying to force an answer at all. And she said one point, it became clear to her that it was just about love. That she loved her son, that she loved her friend, and that there was no one that needed protecting, no one to be pushed away. She felt completely free from her own self-identification. That place where self and other begins to fall away. So the sutra goes on to say, learn humility before others. And she said that that was really what she felt like. She felt great forgiveness for her friend's ignorance and humility in the face of how much pain there is in the world. And also a great deal of love because of all of that pain. She wasn't going to get turned around by it. Humility comes from the word humus. You know, humus is the earth, the good, rich earth. That layer of earth that grows the food we eat, that nourishes the trees and the flowers, the bushes. Those of us who wear the brown jacket wear a brown jacket as a symbol of the earth. We all are of the earth. And we are all part of the earth. And to remember that always, that this earth gave rise to you and to me. And we're not different in that. And we don't need to defend ourselves against each other, because we are all from the same body. And we're all a manifestation of the same body. Learn humility before others and learn humility in themselves. Practice love and compassion and protect all living beings, even the smallest insects. Eiken Roshi, who's one of my teachers, was one of my teachers, told this story about how he lived almost all of his 94 years in Hawaii. And of course there's lots of insects in Hawaii. And he told the story of growing up and being afraid of some of the insects. There's these great big house spiders. They're about the size of my hand and they're black and hairy. And they eat cockroaches. So actually, people really like house spiders. And if you have a house spider and you move from your house to a new house, you try to take your house spider with you. But as a child, he was really afraid of the house spiders. And he said that he began practicing with smaller insects. And he would see a little insect, a little spider in the bathtub, and scoop it up, and take it outside. And he said, first he thought he was doing it for the spider, but then he noticed that, you know, in scooping up the spider and taking it outside, you know, he felt a great deal of compassion for that spider. And then he thought, well, actually the spider is practicing for me. And so then he moved from spiders to geckos. He said there was even finally a time when he was able to pick up a house spider. Sometimes we don't know, you know, who's really practicing. When we really pay close attention to living beings, really close attention to each other, to birds, to dogs and cats. We feel a lot of love. And we don't know if that love is about the animal, the other, or about us. And maybe it's not about either. Maybe it's about something that's more true, deeper and more true. Because when we do feel love and when we do feel compassion, it's because we have stopped all our analytical figuring things out, and we're just letting the natural and true connection that's there be there. When we don't feel any need for any of our weapons, we find that indeed there already is a connection, and it's always been there. In this way that we practice non-killing. So to practice like this, it is a matter of self-reflection. It is a matter of paying attention and reflecting on ourselves, not just the surface, not just the ideas, but looking more deeply into, you know, what is really at the core of our existence, of who we are. And that's what all of these trainings are about, and that's why they're called mindfulness trainings. So in the 1990s, Thay stopped calling them precepts and started calling them mindfulness trainings. If you're reading this book, they're still called precepts in this book. So initially, he just changed what they were called, because that helps us, that they are about training our minds to pay attention, to see what's going on. So the first reiteration of the precept as a mindfulness training was like this: aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life. I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. I think it's interesting that he says, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. Because it is through our compassion that we do learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. It's when we feel a connection with something, when we feel that compassion, that sharing of life, that we know how to protect life. This next line is always something that gives people a lot of problems. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. At Mountain Lamp, where I live, the Rural Practice Center where I live, every morning we chant the four great vows of a bodhisattva. And the first one is, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. And that's a lot like saying, I'm determined not to kill and not to let others kill. When we truly see into our self-nature, our self-nature that is the nature of all things, we know that it's not possible to kill. In that nature that's beyond dualistic thinking of you and me, beyond dualistic thinking of good and bad, right and wrong, birth and death, there's no killing. We can't understand this with our intellectual mind, but it is something we come to know through our practice. When we look at a tree in the fall and it's covered with beautiful leaves, and those leaves fall off the tree, and we think, oh my gosh, all those leaves died. Will the tree continue to live? And of course, in the next spring, new leaves are formed. And the leaves that fall in the autumn are just the nutrition that becomes part of the tree that produces the new leaves in the spring. And nothing dies. And the same is true, ultimately, about all life. That it is a continuous, unending circle. And life is in love with itself. And it keeps manifesting. How marvelous. How miraculous. And when we are attached to a sense of identity that is separate from everything else, through our self-cherishing and our self-hatred, through our dualistic thinking of good and bad, and right and wrong, we are then cut off from that understanding of our deep, profound interconnectedness. And as we practice letting go of our ideas of self and other, good and bad, right and wrong, should and shouldn't, bit by bit we come to see. And sometimes everything falls away, and we see that from the very beginning, underneath all of this separation, is a vast, continuous reality that we can never be separate from. that we are always part of. That we don't die from, we're not born out of. In Buddhism, it might be spoken of as emptiness, or the unborn, or the unconditioned. In Christianity, it might be called God. But it is the true spiritual reality of all existence, and we're part of it right now. And so this mindfulness training says not to condone any act of killing in my thinking and in my way of life. And it begins in our thinking. It begins by being aware of what we're doing in our mind and reflecting upon that. And instead of self-identifying and self-protecting, living in the question of how do I understand this? How do I see more deeply? How do I take refuge in the Buddha mind? And letting the question keep us focused. Keep us focused on cherishing all life. Whatever it is we're focused on, keep us focused. And in that, you know, focus, we stay present in the focus. And out of that great reality, the truth arises, and we see it speaks through us. And it becomes our activity. So the last reiteration of the first mindfulness training, we have a sheet that we'll pass out. This was written about a year and a half ago. It was a Sangha effort, and I haven't taught it so far because there was some sense that they were going to change, and they will change. And that's totally appropriate because certainly everything changes, right? It's called Reverence for Life. And it starts out the same as the mindfulness training I just read. Aware of the suffering caused by destruction of life, I am committed. And it adds something here. I am committed to cultivating the insight of interbeing. A friend told me just a while ago about a fight that he had with his father. And he said that he'd said to his father, you know, you're controlling, and everybody's uptight because of the way you're acting. And his father was, of course, very hurt. And he was very angry. And as he looked at the situation, he saw that indeed a lot of the time he was controlling, and his sort of rules about what's right and what's wrong and how you should be was making the people around him uptight. And he saw that, you know, his father was inside of him. It's important to see that and not avoid it. That is cultivating the insight of interbeing. And when we truly see that, we feel a little more peace, a little forgiveness. And we know that when we're practicing for our father, for our mother. Because if we heal them inside of us, that healing touches them. And our parents don't have to be alive for us to do that kind of work. We heal the separation that's been passed from generation to generation. And as bodhisattvas, you know, we say, I do this for myself, but for everyone. And as soon as we say that, everything is supporting us. This is what I was talking about yesterday when I talked about taking refuge. As soon as we're willing to say, you know, it felt like he's controlling. Sometimes it feels like I'm controlling. I don't understand where all this comes from. But I'm willing to live in the question of, how do I heal this? How do I transform this? For my sake, but also for the sake of my parent, my child, my friends, for all beings. As soon as we're willing to step forth like that and let go of our own weaponry, everything supports us. The great reality is supporting us because the great reality is that connection and love. And it wants to manifest. And it only manifests if it has a body. And the only body it can have is yours and mine. So I'm committed to cultivating the insight of interbeing and compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals. I'm determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. Seeing that harmful actions arise from anger, fear, greed, and intolerance, which in turn come from dualistic and discriminative thinking, I will cultivate openness, non-discrimination and non-attachment to views in order to transform violence, fanaticism, and dogmatism in myself and in the world. So I think something that's really important about this last sentence is indeed seeing for ourselves that our actions arise, when they arise out of anger, that they may arise out of fear or greed or intolerance. And seeing that is wonderful, is huge, to be able to say, ah, I made a mistake and I was really angry. Just being able to admit that and not blame the other person or beat ourselves up already, you know, cuts right through that discriminative thinking. It's like, oh, it's admitting what the Buddha said right from the very beginning, life is messy. There is anger, there is fear, there is greed, and there is intolerance, and it's in all of us. And it's okay. It's absolutely okay. As long as we recognize it, hold it gently, and don't make that our self-identity. Don't think, this is who I am, and I have every right to be this way. But to see that it is the cause of suffering, and it's our attachment to those ideas that cause suffering, where suffering arises. It's our attachment to, by golly, I'm right, that person really did say something terrible and I have every reason to hate them. Well, maybe that's true. Maybe that person did something that really hurt us, and we have reason to hate them. But if we get caught there, we get caught in that place of the small self, the separate self. And it is a suffering place. Our hatred hurts us. Our anger hurts us. And it hurts others. It's not separate. And so when we see it arising, and it is a matter of looking inside ourselves and acknowledging, yeah, I'm pissed off. Yeah, that's okay. But then immediately knowing that I'm pissed off, I'm upset, and I take refuge in the Buddha mind. I take refuge in the teachings that show me the way to practice love and understanding. I take refuge in my friends, in the fresh breezes, in the cool rain. So we don't get caught there. Because we're looking to touch something that is more true about ourselves, about each other, about all of existence. If we're practicing the Buddha way and the precepts, then we already have acknowledged that there is something more true about our lives than our hatred, our fear, our distractions, our greed. And that's what we want to touch and manifest in the world. So I will cultivate openness, non-discrimination, and non-attachment to views in order to transform violence, fanaticism, and dogmatism in myself and in the world. Very nice. You know, it's a very clear teaching of practice. I think it is helpful to look at all of these. The first precept, the sutra, and the white-clad disciple, the first mindfulness training and reverence for life. I think it's helpful. And I think it's helpful not to get caught in the words. Not to get caught in... but to use the words as a teaching to reflect upon our own minds, our own actions, and remember deeply what our commitment is. And it's expressed very beautifully and simply in that first precept: cherish all life. Cherish yourself. Cherish each other. We are one body. So for those of you who sign up, make the commitments to do the practice period. There's a series of study questions, as well as the four reiterations of the precept, first precept. And the study questions, again, are for self-reflection, not to tie yourself in knots, not to make life difficult, but... to help you to look deeply and think deeply and lovingly about yourself in this practice. I just wanted to end with a quote from Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma was the first ancestor in China. He brought the teachings of the Buddha from India across rivers and mountains to China. And how he expressed the first precept is, self-nature is subtle and mysterious. If we really look at our lives, what a great mystery it all is. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What's the next moment? How mysterious. Self-nature is subtle and mysterious in the realm of the everlasting Dharma. Not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. When all ideas of self and other fall away, there's no thought of killing, nothing to kill, no one to do the killing. And what we find there is our profound, ever-changing interconnectedness. And we see that from the very beginning, everything is blessed. Everything is blessed. So practice cherishing all life. If you can have that, just that to focus your mind. Begin each morning with that. How do I cherish all life? And don't use it to beat yourself up, but simply as a way to come back and focus. It's like, ah, yes, how beautiful is this flower? How wonderful is this step? How delicious is this drink of water? How wonderful is this hug from my friend? How lovely.